kært barn har mange navne. Det har et ukært barn også, som for eksempel autokrati. Det hedder også enevælde, diktatur, tyranni, despoti, eneherskerdømme, totalitarisme og en stribe andre navne på udøvelse af enevældig magt. Autokrati har som ord og begreb eksisteret siden tidernes morgen og har med sine mange navne været den mest udbredte styreform gennem det meste af vores historie. Men det er først i de senere år, at ordet autokrati har fundet indpas og fortrængt de andre mere almindelige udtryk. Autokrati er vores tids navn. Det 21. århundredes brand, der står for udøvelse af diktatorisk magt med vold og undertrykkelse af menneskerettigheder, ytringsfrihed og knægtelse af de øvrige politiske og sociale rettigheder, man kender og respekterer i liberale demokratier. Vores tid vil blive stående i historien som den periode, da autokrati fik sit gennembrud og en ny opblomstring. Fremtidens historikere vil måske tale om vores tid som diktaturets renaissance, ikke med en klang af genfødsel for videnskab, kunst, filosofi og litteratur, som den italienske renaissance indvarslede. Men en tilbagevenden til fortidens diktaturregimer med krig, masseødelæggelser, folkedrab og millioner af flygtninge. Intet nyt under solen. Fjendskab, krig og udslettelse af hele befolkningsgrupper er vores histories evige ledsager. Vi ser det udfolde sig for fuld styrke nu, da krige raser i Ukraine og i Mellemøsten, og med fare for, at krige kan bryde ud andre steder på kloden. Vi lever i en krigstid. Jeg har ikke selv været direkte udsat for autokrati, men har dog smagt på det som barn under Stalins tyranni og terrorstyre i Sovjetunionen, da jeg voksede op i Sibirien. Min families historie er også fortællingen om to af det 20. århundredes største tyranner og forbrydere, Hitler og Stalin. Deres ikke-angrebspagt var i virkeligheden en alliance og fik betydning for millioner af mennesker. De blev ofrene for den pagt, også mine forældre. Som en del af den alliance besatte de sovjetiske tropper Litauen og de to andre baltiske lande. De nationaliserede alt privat ejendom. Familien mistede alt, hvad de ejede. Røveri ved højlysdag. Derefter blev de deporteret til Sibirien to dage inden Hitler brød pagten og gik i krig mod Sovjetunionen. På krigens første dag stod de tyske tropper i den lille litauiske by, hvorfra mine forældre var blevet deporteret to dage før. Alle de jødiske familier, der ikke var blevet deporteret af Stalin, blev udryddet af de nazistiske specialkommandoer. Mine forældre, mine to søskende og min farmor undslap den skæbne på et hængende hår. I virkeligheden havde historiens to mest blodige autokrater par excellence stillet mine forældre over for et valg mellem Auschwitz eller Gulag. De slap for Hitler og Auschwitz, og Stalin og Gulag blev deres redning. Det var ikke en evakuering, det var en straf. Men alligevel fristes jeg til at sige tak, kammerat Stalin, fordi du deporterede mine forældre og reddede deres liv. For mit eget vedkommende nåede jeg som barn at opleve Stalins autokrati som efterdønninger af den hæmningsløse personkult, der nåede helt ud til mig i den sibiriske udørk, inden diktatoren døde. Men det, jeg fik med, var nok til at vaccinere mig effektivt mod alt det, der har at gøre med diktatur og autokrati og undertrykkelse af det enkelte menneskes friheds- og ytringstrang. Med de løgne, det hykleri og den hjernevask, der følger med som en del af autokratiernes ballast. Da jeg som 10-årig kom sejlende med min familie til København, på en solskinsdag i juli 1957 åbnede Danmark sin favn og lærte mig alt om demokrati, frihed, respekt for det enkelte menneske og retten til at vælge frit. Jeg har aldrig sluppet det favntag, og det gik hurtigt og let med at sige, her har jeg hjemme. Og tak for det. Med det 20. århundredes historie i tankerne er det bemærkelsesværdigt, at autokratiet i forskellige former og nuancer igen har fundet indpas. Det er opblomstret ikke kun i Rusland og andre samfund, hvor enevælde har hersket igennem århundreder, men også i demokratiske lande. Etablerede demokratier som for eksempel USA har med fænomener som Donald Trump og hans MAGA-bevægelse afsløret tendenser, der går i retning af autokratiet.
He says, you're not going to be a dictator, are you? I said, no, 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 other than day one.
Under valgkampen spillede han umiskendeligt op til holdninger og værdier, man identificerer med autokrati.
Get out, you gotta get out and vote. In 4 years you don't have to vote again. We'll have it fixed so good you're not gonna have to.
The peaceful transfer of power, the cornerstone of American democracy, seemed a highly abstract concept today.
Angrebet på kongressen den 6. januar 2021 viste en voldsparathed, der kom bag på både amerikanere og udlændinge.
As Trump supporters clashed with police as they tried and succeeded to storm the Congress where America's elected leaders had gathered to certify the election victory of Joe Biden.
Også i Europa har både ældre og yngre demokratier vist tilsvarende tegn på sympati for autokrati og tiltrækning af diktatoriske metoder. Det foregår med forkærlighed for nationalisme, forherligelse af en glorværdig fortid, med fremhævelse af dem og os som en variant over velkendte fascistiske bestanddele. Det 21. århundredes fascismevariant med sine særlige kendetegn og afvigelser, uden at vige tilbage fra anvendelse af vold, som det skete den 6. januar 2021 under angrebet på Capitol Hill. Den mand, der ansporede til det voldelige angreb for sin vilje og bliver om kort tid indsat som USA's næste præsident, nøjagtigt på det sted, hvor oprøret fandt sted for nøjagtigt 4 år og 14 dage siden. Autokratiet 2024 lever og udfolder sig i fuld flor i pagt med det 21. århundredes betingelser. Hvad der var utænkeligt for 10 år siden har snedet sig ind gennem nyåbnede sprækker, der afslører større modtagelighed og tolerance i teori og praksis både blandt de autokratisk sindede og deres omgivelser. Måske allertydeligst i Rusland, hvor Putin har taget skridtet fra ældgammelt tankegods om den russiske verden, til den implementering, der nu har rundet 1.000 dage med krig, med uendelig mange flere sårede og dræbte på begge sider, og kun med 3 måneder til, at vi går ind i 4. år med krig. Det er krigstid. Og krig og autokrati passer godt til hinanden. De vandrer til håbe. Jeg hedder Samuel Rachlin, og jeg er vært på Krigstid, en podcast fra Kristeligt Dagblad. I dag handler det om autokrati, som måske kommer til at give navn til hele den periode, vi lever i nu. Autokrati som styreform er ved at blive stueren som en del af vores politiske kultur. Det er ikke overraskende, at det kan ske i de lande med en lang tradition for enevælde og totalitarisme, som i Rusland, Tyrkiet og andre lande, hvor demokrati er et fremmed ord. De mere ubefæstede nye demokratier kan lettere blive udnyttet af autokratisk sindede politikere, som for eksempel i Ungarn og Polen. Men vi har også set, hvordan populistiske politikere med autokratiske tilbøjeligheder kan påvirke den politiske virkelighed både i Frankrig og England, i Holland og i flere andre solide demokratier. For en politiker med de aspirationer er det nærliggende og fristende at tænke, at når det kan lade sig gøre i USA, når Trump kan komme afsted med den dagsorden, så kan jeg også. Trump er blevet en rollemodel for politikere med autokratdrømme. Den enkelte magtfulde leder er igen blevet den helt centrale figur, der samler al magt og styrer alt, hvad enten man kalder ham diktator, enehersker eller autokrat. Lige siden Trump dukkede op på den politiske scene i USA i 2015 for at stille op som præsidentkandidat, har analytikere, forskere, journalister og politikere skrevet og talt og advaret om truslen mod det amerikanske demokrati. De taler om de trusler, der kommer fra populister, autokrater og på det seneste fra den fascisme, som flere og flere, i stadig mere uforblommet form, er begyndt at identificere og tale om uden forbehold. Kortlægningen af de fænomener er i fuld gang, som et forsøg på at blotlægge årsagerne til det autokratiske boom, som vi har været vidner til i det første kvarte århundrede af det 21. århundrede. Den nyeste kortlægning kommer fra Anne Applebaum, en kendt og anerkendt amerikansk historiker, forfatter og journalist. Hun har udgivet en stribe anmelderroste bøger om kommunismens forbrydelser i Sovjetunionen, om hungersnøden i Ukraine, om den kolde krig og truslerne mod demokratiet. Hun er vores gæst i denne udgave af Krigstid. Hanne Eibelbaums nye bog hedder Autocracy Inc., eller Autokrati AS i den danske udgave, og er en gennemgang af, hvordan tidens autokratier udgør et globalt netværk og indgår i uformelle kleptokratiske grupperinger, der støtter hinanden i et forsøg på at styrke deres indflydelse, konsolidere deres magt og rigdomme og begrænse de liberale demokratier. De ser dem som deres største trussel og udgør det fjendebillede, der er de vigtigste forudsætninger for autokratiernes beståen. Interviewet foregår på engelsk. Anne Eibelbaum, I'm delighted to welcome you from Copenhagen. Thank you for joining us from your home in Poland.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Ezra Klein from the New York Times had you in his own show the other day. And the first thing he told you was that when you are back in the studio, it's a sign that the times are really bad. Are you worried that you are getting a reputation that identifies you with bad news? Everyone, watch out. The Lady of Gloom and Doom is here. Almost like the Queen of Darkness.
So I don't think I'm that bad. I mean, I think in real life I'm quite cheerful, but it's true that I have I've made some predictions that turned out to be true, and so now people are worried that others might also be true. And it's true that I keep warning. I think what I'm doing is just being realistic. I just describe what I see, and people are sometimes bothered by that. So I'm sorry if it's upsetting. But
no, it's not upsetting to me because I agree with most of what you have said. I have said similar things for years, so I'm not upset.
Well, that's good. At least someone isn't.
Joking apart, give us your sense of the state, not just of the Union, but the state of the world. That is pretty much what your book, Autocracy Inc., is about. Autocracy, democracy, the new world order, and a bleak outlook for a new world with the confluence of bad events and bad people.
My book describes a specific aspect of the world. It describes a group of autocratic states which have very different ideologies. So we're talking about communist China and nationalist Russia and theocratic Iran and Bolivarian socialist Venezuela and Syria and Nicaragua and Cuba. They're very, very different from one another. But they've nevertheless begun to cooperate. They cooperate because they, although they have different goals and language and aesthetics and so on, they do share a desire to rule without checks and balances, without the rule of law, without a real opposition, without independent media, without independent voices. And increasingly, they've come to understand that they need to push back against those things and those ideas, not only inside their own countries, but around the world. So in international institutions, but also inside our countries. They support information wars inside Europe and in North America. They also are funding real wars. The war in Ukraine is now an international war. It's Russia being aided directly by Iran and North Korea, including North Korean troops, as well as by components and trade from China. And they also seek to cooperate in the business world and in finance. They invest in one another's countries. They're the kind of quasi-state, quasi-private companies in one country have relationships with the quasi-state private companies in another. And so they begin to form a kind of, it's not an alliance, it's nothing that formal. It's just a group of states that have common interests and work together opportunistically. And this has been in the making for 10 years, but the effects of it and the impact of it are becoming clearer and clearer. And as I said, they do have some clear goals. And one of their most important goals is to undermine us. And by that, I mean us, American, Danes, Europeans.
Yes, the democratic community. When your book came out, I thought, great timing. But now some people may ask you, wasn't it too late, Anne Eibelbaum?
I mean, some of what's in the book are things that I've written about for a long time. So I, you know, the there was a large article which made more or less this argument that appeared, you know, 3 years ago, and other topics and subjects in the book I've also been writing about for a long time. And the information part of it, you know, originally it was the Russian, I think disinformation is the wrong word. These were information campaigns run by Russia inside European countries and inside, you know, inside the United States, that I've been writing about for 10 years or more. You know, the only recent change is that the Chinese have now joined and other states are now doing the same thing. So you now have a broader group of countries trying to do it. I feel that people, you know, many people have been writing about it. It's just that, you know, the status quo works for people. They like the institutions as they are. They haven't been ready for any kind of radical reform. You know, maybe now they will be.
I'm not trying to say that you missed the train, but my point was that, you know, much harm has already been done by this brotherhood of autocrats.
I mean, yes, that's indisputably true. I mean, again, Russian money and Russian information campaigns have now been copied and imitated everywhere. You know, there are whole political parties, you know, the AfD in Germany or you know, the far right part on the American political spectrum that have used and made use of Russian examples. The Chinese have already gone a long way towards changing the geopolitics of Africa through a huge investment strategy and as well as an information strategy. And of course, the war in Ukraine, which really begins in 2014, not 2022, has already changed the security situation in Europe.
Definitely.
You know, why are we already, we're all making weapons in a way that we didn't think we'd ever have to do again. We're beginning to, maybe in the next few weeks, we'll confront some choices that we didn't think we'd ever have to make again, you know, maybe deploying troops or maybe beginning to think about a broader involvement in the war to prevent some kind of collapse or disaster. And I think that's, you know, that's the impact of this, you know, of, you know, Autocracy Inc., of this coordinated group, you know, over the last decade.
To dive into the substance of Autocracy Inc., what's the main thesis in the book?
Well, I mean, the main thesis is the one that I've said that there is a group of countries who cooperate and who work together, and then the book details and lays out the different, you know, different examples and different ways in which this happens, and then it shows some of the impact as well, that some of the ways of fighting autocracy that used to work in the past, you know, the creation of big civic movements, creations of connections between people inside dictatorships. Some of those don't work as well as they used to, because the autocrats have learned how to fight civic unrest and protest. But the book also makes some suggestions about what we can do.
That's what I was trying to fish for. What can we do?
So, well, I mean, some of it is really now things that Europe will have to do. So, for example, in the book, I talk a lot about kleptocracy, and the, you know, in all, most of us who if you live in Denmark or you live in Poland or like I do, or America, most of us live in an economy in which we pay taxes. If we have businesses, we respect regulations. Our names are on the names of our companies, or are on the documents, and everybody knows who we are. There, in addition to that, there is a parallel economy that exists alongside the regular one, in which there are shell companies that have anonymous owners. Money can be moved around the world very quickly in ways that are hidden from governments. People don't pay taxes. They don't abide by regulations. And something like 10% of the world's wealth is now maybe in this offshore world. This is the world, as I also describe in the book, that the autocracies make great use of. They hide their money there. They use money there for subterfuge and for influence campaigns. And this is something that could be destroyed. I mean, you know, this is a world that exists because of laws that we have made. We in the in the Western world, and we could change the laws, and we could make it impossible for people to hide money or to use it in secret ways. We could make social media companies respect the law. So if you're a newspaper like you work for, or like I work for, we have to respect the laws of our country. There are laws on broadcasting, there are laws on libel, whatever the laws of our specific states. The social media companies don't have to respect the law. And why? It makes no sense that there should be this world alongside the real world in which people can do things that are illegal. We've all learned now, I think, a lesson about what deterrence is for. You know, what was the reason the Russians invaded Ukraine? Well, there were many reasons. One was to demonstrate how weak the West was and how meaningless all the laws and rules and international institutions are, with the UN Charter and the Geneva Conventions and so on. That was one of the reasons. One of the other reasons was that they thought they could do it because they thought we weren't prepared. They weren't scared of Ukraine. Ukraine wasn't armed.
Yeah.
Ukraine, you know, had a few little weapons here and there, yes, but there hadn't been a big effort to defend Ukraine. And
they did it because they could do it simply.
They thought it was going to be simple. It was going to be over in a few days. And by the way, this war is a big disaster for Putin. I mean, in any, you know, any step back for a few minutes and look at it, it's a huge crisis. I mean, it was a war that was supposed to be over quickly. That wasn't. He's lost by the British government's count 700,000 casualties. That includes dead and wounded.
Yeah.
Billions of dollars worth of equipment, planes, submarines. Uncounted tanks and armored cars and so on. I mean, all that has been lost. And so he one of the reasons he's now so desperate to stay in the war is that he needs to justify why he began it in the first place. But had he been deterred, had we armed Ukraine, had he been afraid to invade Ukraine, he might not have done it. And I think all of us now understand that we need to deter him in the Baltic states and not just in Eastern Europe, but in Scandinavia, maybe even in Germany. I mean, one thing about Putin, he said repeatedly that any territory that was once controlled by the Russian Empire could be part of it again. And of course, he spent the first part of his career as effectively as a functionary in the Soviet Empire in East Germany. So he remembers when East Germany was part of what he would call Russia.
Yeah, yeah. And he credited Peter the Great for that approach because, he met with those young students and told them that Peter the Great never conquered any territory. He just took back what was originally Russian.
Right, exactly right. I think people are finally maybe beginning to understand that there's a genuine threat. It's both a military threat. It's also there's an information war going on that we haven't taken seriously enough.
Yeah.
There is an economic war going on that we haven't taken seriously enough. And all of those things are aimed at undermining our political systems getting ready for it, beginning to fight back is what we need to do.
And let me ask you about populism that we have seen and described and written about much longer than this modern autocracy. Do you see populism as we have seen it in the Western world and globally, was a precursor to what we are having now with autocracy?
So I actually I don't like the word populism because it has several different meanings. I mean, in the United States, there was a populist movement in the 19th century. Which
yes,
was very,
that's the origins.
What we mean by populism now. I think what is worrying is not populism more broadly, but is a very specific form of populism.
Yes.
Which can be either left-wing or right-wing, I should say. I mean, the Venezuelan leader, Hugo Chavez, was a left-wing autocratic populist. Viktor Orban is a right-wing autocratic populist. And yet they use many of the same tactics. And so it's a way of, it starts out as a political movement that describes only one part, you know, in a democracy. They both began as democracies. Venezuela used to be a democracy too. That describes one political grouping as the only real or true nation, you know, the real Hungarians or the real Venezuelans or the real people, authentic people, as against the foreigners or the elites or the traitors, you know, on the other side. And once in a democracy, once you have one political party that doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the other side, once you have that, then, you know, and then that's usually a sign. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're, you know, that there will be a democratic collapse. But once you go down that road, it's possible. And then once a political party like that takes power and then begins to dismantle the structures of the state, so usually the judiciary is how they start, or the civil service, or the that begins to capture the state, by which I mean taking over state institutions, and instead of having them belong to everybody, they belong only to the political party or leader. So they act in the financial and political interests of the leader, whether it's state media or whether it's regulatory agencies, you know, their purpose changes.
Tell me, is it at all possible, or are you able to say who epitomizes today's autocrat more than anyone else? Is there such a thing as a role model?
No, I mean, some of them, you know, the Putin was a kind of role model for kleptocratic leaders. He was the first to, he and his cohort, his generation of security officers who became involved in looting, stealing money from Russia, taking it abroad, laundering it in the West through Western institutions and bringing it back in. I mean, he created that system, and that's been copied by a lot of other autocratic leaders and states, you know, so in that sense. But I mean, the Chinese also are a model for a lot of the developing world. You know, they have an argument that we were able to achieve great economic success by, you know, while maintaining control through our one party state. And that's also a model for a lot of other, you know, many other countries admire that.
But do you see the trend that we have observed in Russia with the oligarchs as a class? Is that being something that is also appearing in other structures and in other systems and in other political cultures?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, the equivalent of oligarchs play a huge role in China. Hungary recreated the phenomenon of the oligarchs in almost exactly the same way. The Hungarian state the Hungarian ruling party, not the state. The Hungarian ruling party empowered wealthy people to buy up newspapers, to crowd out other kinds of businesses. Hungary is absolutely an oligarchic state now. So yes, many people have copied that system.
You also write that impunity is one of the distinguishable features of autocracies. And this new class also, including this class of oligarchs, is crime and the criminal world one of the sort of permanent patterns of autocracy, fellow travelers, so to speak?
Some of them have a very intimate relationship with crime. I mean, the Russian state has, and the Russian mafia are also intimately connected. I mean, the difference between people who have state jobs and the people who have jobs in the criminal underworld is often not very great. I mean, they know each other. They use the same systems to send money around the world and so on. No, these are, many of them are semi-criminal states. I mean, I don't want to, some of these states operate a little bit differently. Not all of them do, but it's certainly true that all of them use the system of alternative finance, the system of hidden money, shell companies. You know, they use the tools of the kleptocratic world to move their money around. I think all of them do that, yes.
I would like to bring in one other element that we haven't touched upon, but that is constantly popping up more and more frequently, and that is fascism in our sort of public discourse and debate. So what is the distinction between tyrants of the past that you write about and today's autocrats, the full-blown ones and the aspiring ones? Does autocracy and fascism walk together?
You can certainly look at many far-right movements in the modern world, including the MAGA movement in the United States, and including some of the far-right movements in Europe. And there are a lot of echoes of fascism. There are some of the same tactics, the same bending of the truth, the same, you know, even some of the exactly. Trump, I think, deliberately uses some of the same language that was used in the 1930s. I'm always reluctant to talk about fascism because I feel that it makes people immediately think of Nazis and the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it's useful. You know, it's not wrong. I understand why there are a lot of scholars, you know, Tim Snyder or Jason Stanley, and there are a lot of scholars who've written about Trumpism in particular as a form of modern fascism. And I understand why they do it, because I see exactly the same thing that they see, the same parallel.
Yeah.
The same description of enemies as vermin or as enemies of the state or as traitors and so on. I mean, all that comes directly from the 1930s.
Well, you brought up Trump. That was my next question. In your view, where does he belong? We haven't touched upon him at all, but where does he belong in this equation?
So to be clear, you know, the United States is not going to be an autocracy. It's not going to be Russia. The rule of law holds. It's a very large country. There's a federal system. There are judges at many levels, not just the Supreme Court, who will abide by the rule of law. But it is true that what Trump has talked about during the election campaign, but also since being election, does sound very much like state capture, what I was talking about before, that he's interested in taking over the institutions of the state and making them work for him personally.
Yes. Sorry. I just want to pick up on that you said that it's not going to be an autocracy. America is not going to become an autocracy. And you mentioned that the judicial system holds up. It holds. How can you say that when to many outsiders, it looks as if Trump has, been taking on the judicial system and shown that he can work around it.
He did manage to escape justice. I didn't know that was entirely the fault of the judicial system. It was also the slowness of Biden's Department of Justice, the failure to bring the case, the one case that really mattered against him, which was the January 6th case, you know, in 2021. Why did they wait until the very last possible moment? It was partly there were other people at fault besides particular judges. So are there flaws in the system? Yes. I mean, the Supreme Court is now dominated by conservatives who are willing to give presidential immunity. There are some lower courts, including famously one in Florida, where there are a few judges in place who are willing to, who proved willing to excuse Trump. Let him off the hook. But, you know, it's a big court system. There are a lot of federal courts. Not all the judges are, not all the judges are corrupt. Even Republican appointed judges historically have been interested in defending the Constitution, not defending Trump personally. I mean, what will be dangerous would be the emergence of a class of judges, and this could happen over 4 years, actually, who are not loyal to the Constitution, who don't have a theory of, there's different constitutional theories in America that are conservative or more liberal, who don't have don't follow one of those theories, but are simply there in order to defend Donald Trump. And that we already have one or two judges like that, but having more of them would permanently change America. Yes.
Yeah, it looks like he will be able to pick another judge for justice for the Supreme Court during this next.
We'll see. Probably it's most likely that one or two of the conservative judges will resign. There are two who are old and also have been accused of corruption, I think, legitimately, and might. Maybe they would now use this opportunity to bow out. But we don't know that yet. I'm just speculating.
In wrapping up, Anne, in your dedication on the first page of your book, you write, "For the optimists." But in the epilogue of your book, you write about Democrats United. And it's not absolutely clear, to me at least, whether you are speaking as an optimist or a pessimist. Is it a bit of a mixed message here between reflection and wishful thinking. So it's now time for confessions. And are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I would say that I'm an optimist who worries a lot. You know, look, the book is dedicated to the people who I know who have really dedicated their lives to changing their countries. I know Russians, I know Belarusians, I know Venezuelans. I have a friend from Zimbabwe. I have friends from all over the world, from Iran, you know, who continue to work for change, even in very, very difficult conditions. And I really admire them. And wanted to dedicate the book to them because they are optimists. They think they can do something.
Yes.
And I also think that we who live in these unbelievably wealthy, safe, you know, free societies, maybe the wealthiest, safest, and freest societies ever in human history, we don't really have the right to be pessimists. We have an obligation to continue working. You know, to make our countries better and to make the world better, because we have this, we've been given this gift, and we have to preserve it. And so I'm a dedicated optimist for that reason alone.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note to conclude on, and I would do it by thanking you once again for being here and talking to us. So, Anne Applebaum, thank you once again for being with us and talking to us from Poland, and we say thanks from Copenhagen.
Thank you very much.
Hvad Anne Applebaum viser med stor overbevisning både i sin bog og i vores samtale er, at vi lever i en skelsættende tid. En tid, hvor vores verden gennemgår en historisk geopolitisk forandring, der vil ændre det verdensbillede, vi har levet med i den største del af de foregående århundreder. Og det fremgår også, at det er den verden, de nye generationer kommer til at leve med i en god del af det 21. århundrede. Det er billedet af autokrater og autokratiske systemer, der vinder frem og truer demokratierne på livet. Hun ser det som et system, der udgør et netværk af autokratier, der holder sammen og støtter hinanden. Vi kan ikke længere tage demokratiet for givet og urokkeligt. Ikke kun på grund af de nye autokrater, der vælter frem udefra, men også fordi demokratiet er truet indefra. Applebaum dokumenterer, hvad jeg selv også har talt og skrevet om, nemlig at man kan bruge demokratiet til at afskaffe demokratiet. Ikke kun i de nye, ubefæstede demokratier, men også i de gamle, veletablerede demokratier, som for eksempel i USA og i Vesteuropa. På den måde er Applebaums bog et opråb til os alle om at vågne op. Hvad der måske er det mest overraskende ved samtalen med Applebaum og hendes bog, er, at vi har været så langsomme og så dårlige til at opfange tidens signaler og indstille os på, hvordan man skal afværge truslerne. De trusler, der har undergravet vores systemer og værdier og gjort det i overvis. De fleste har ignoreret den og sovet i timen. Det har været undervejs længe og ikke som spredte, isolerede fænomener, men som markante globale bevægelser og tendenser. Det bliver interessant at se, hvordan fremtidens historikere vil forklare tidens blindhed og uformåenhed, når det drejer sig om vores egne vitale interesser. Når jeg selv i overvis har været bekymret og har advaret om de farer, der truer de vestlige demokratier, både fra autokraterne rundt omkring i verden og populisterne i vores egne politiske systemer, så er det svært at påstå, at man er blevet mere bekymret over Applebaums advarsler. Hun har dokumenteret og bekræftet, at de bekymringer er fuldstændig berettigede, og at der er mere end rigeligt at tage sig i agt for. Og at vi er sent ude med at gøre noget for at sætte en stopper for det. Lad os håbe, det ikke er for sent. Men man kan så sige, at Anne Applebaum har gjort sit for at slå alarm. Det var dagens afsnit af Krigstid, en podcast fra Kristeligt Dagblad. Mit navn er Samuel Rachlin, og podcasten er produceret i samarbejde med redaktør Frederik Melgaard Lauritsen. Og tak, fordi du lyttede med.